Morning. Aha, you're all awake. So glad to have you with us this morning. And before I have my time to introduce the secretary, I'll introduce a couple of others that are in the audience this morning with us. Colleen Thomas from Senator Cole's office is here. Brad Pfaff, who is the state director for the Farm Service Agency. Stan Grzynski, who is the Director of Rural Development, and Pat Leavenworth, who is the State Conservationist for NRCS. And I'm going to make an official announcement today, Pat. She has served how many years? 33 years for NRCS and has chosen to retire at the end of this month. So she will be missed. And now it's my great honor to introduce to you the Secretary of the USDA, Secretary Vilsack. And he is a secretary for 4 years now, has led the agency with distinction. Prior to that, he was the governor of Iowa for 2 terms. And as I mentioned yesterday, he is long known for his endeavors in Iowa to improve the rural communities. He improved the rural communities through the internet systems established in Iowa, as well as programs to help enhance their economic viability. So, Secretary Vilsack, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We look forward to your remarks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, Secretary, thank you very much, and thank you for your leadership. We've been together the last couple of days, and yesterday the secretary decided he'd put a plug in for Wisconsin agriculture and suggested that it compared favorably to Iowa agriculture on the dairy side and the cheese side. Of course, I then had to remind him about eggs, corn, beans, and hogs, but we agreed that we could put a very good breakfast together between our two states. He's doing a great job in his position, and I was interested to learn yesterday of the role that his office is playing in providing help and assistance to people who are struggling through a tough economy. We were at the Catholic Multicultural Center, and there were AmeriCorps volunteers there that were helping train individuals who were finding it hard to find a place to work. They were training them on packaging fresh vegetables from Wisconsin producers that would be going to school districts where there was a significant increase of free and reduced lunch kids, and training these folks to have jobs in that area. And the secretary's office basically helps to define and find these AmeriCorps volunteers, and suggested that he could really help our secretary, Bill Northey, down in Iowa, who's got a farm-to-school program to maybe patterned after what's the great work that's being done in Wisconsin. First of all, I'm really happy to be here at the Dairy Expo. I understand this is a very, very large opportunity every year here in the state of Wisconsin to celebrate the achievements and successes of dairy, even in the most difficult and tough times as we face today. Very large opportunity. The Secretary and I are going to take a tour afterwards, but we probably don't have enough time to see it all. But we've got a number of countries represented here. Nearly 2,500 foreign visitors come. About 70,000 people participate in the week-long efforts. A lot of exhibitors, nearly 900, and so there's a lot to see and a lot to do. And I think it's appropriate that we every year have an opportunity to celebrate what dairy does for this country. I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to talk a little bit about the difficult times that dairy is currently experiencing, and then I want to talk a little bit about the status of what I refer to as the Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill, and then we'll take questions. And the Secretary has agreed to answer all of the tough ones. that's why I wanted you on the stage, man. let's first and foremost take a step back and recognize the extraordinary story that dairy production is in this country. The productivity and efficiency of our dairy operations is something that is absolutely remarkable and is reflective of the overall story of agriculture. Since 1980, agriculture has been the second most productive aspect of our economy. Very few people recognize or realize that, but we've seen enormous gains in the capacity of American agriculture to produce. In 1980, the average cow would generate about 13,000 pounds of milk. Today, that's about 21,000 pounds, so there's been an enormous increase in productivity. And that says a great deal about the producers, their willingness to embrace new technologies, new strategies to be more efficient. When you produce more, you have an opportunity not just to meet the domestic need for milk, but you also create new opportunities by export. And so we've seen a profound increase in the amount of our milk products that are exported. And certainly Wisconsin knows a lot about that with the number one status that you have as a cheese processor and manufacturer. A lot of that gets exported because you have created a brand. You've created a reputation that people around the world want to enjoy. And so we've seen almost a quadrupling of export activity in just the last 15 years in dairy, doing close to $5 billion of exports. Now, that also is not just an increased opportunity for farmers, but it also helps to support jobs. Every $1 billion of ag sales generates about 7,800 jobs. So this is a part of the industry, the export part, which is helping to support almost 40,000 people to be employed. And that's often not appreciated. Then there's dairy's contribution to the environment. The dairy industry stepped up several years ago and made a very significant commitment within its supply chain of reducing its greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by the year 2020. Set a real example for all of agriculture. And working through the Dairy Innovation Center, which Senator Cole and others were responsible for assisting in creating, we're on track to basically meet that goal. And we are working in partnership with the Dairy Innovation Center, with dairy producers, with our rural development and farm service agency operations to help finance a series of anaerobic digesters, capturing the methane and converting it into fuel and energy. An extraordinary story, and the dairy producers have stepped up, and we have been financing through USDA almost one anaerobic digester a week since the announcement was made. And we will continue to make that commitment because the dairy producers are there. And then there's the issue of health. The reality is that we're dealing in this country with some serious health consequences, not the least of which is that a third of our youngsters are obese or at risk of being obese. It is so significant that retired admirals and generals actually went to Congress and asked Congress to provide the USDA the ability to reform and to improve school lunch and school breakfast programs. Now, you say, why retired generals and admirals? Because they're deeply concerned about the number of youngsters who are qualified and fit for military service. We have an all-volunteer military, which means that we have to have a large pool of young people capable of serving the country. But today, only 25% of youngsters 19 to 24 years of age are fit for military service. That's a very small percentage. And one of the principal reasons for that is that youngsters aren't physically fit enough to do the work the military requires. So dairy steps up, provides a nutrition, provides the ability to inform, if you will, a more nutritious school lunch and school breakfast program by focusing on low-fat dairy. And that's a critical component of our effort, and we're going to try to improve the consumption of low-fat dairy as part of that revised school lunch and school breakfast program. So whether it's helping farmers and farm income, meeting the domestic needs for dairy production, increasing productivity, expanding exports, working to protect the environment, or simply working with the country to reduce the risks of chronic diseases associated with obesity, dairy producers are up front and helping to lead the way. Now, that's all great, but of course it's very difficult today in the context of where we are in this particular year for dairy producers. We recognize and appreciate that the drought has had significant impacts on all producers. We haven't seen a drought like this since 1988, something as wide and as deep as this drought. Fortunately, on the crop production side, we have crop insurance, and in fact, producers were wise enough to utilize that risk management tool in a way that reduces what could have been extraordinarily devastating. And in fact, 85% of our producers actually have crop insurance. The problem, though, is that dairy producers don't have that kind of help and assistance, or they did until midnight of a day or so ago when the MILC payment program went out of existence because the 2008 Farm Bill expired and Congress did not replace it with any other mechanism. Now, you all know that in the bill that passed the Senate, there is a discussion of a new structure for dairy, margin insurance protection. A lot of controversy about this, but I think the reality of it is that it's a recognition that dairy can't continue to have the instability and volatility that we've seen over the course of the last 10, 15 years with significant price spikes and very deep depressed prices and the band between those spikes shortening, so that producers simply don't have the time to rebound from a difficult year. We had a tough year in 2009. We tried to step up at USDA to provide help and assistance, got through that. We lost some producers, but we didn't have enough time before we began to hit another depressed set of prices. Prices seem to be rebounding a bit, but we're still confronted, obviously, with high feed costs. And we would at USDA would like to provide more assistance than we have. In terms of the drought, we opened up hay and grazing opportunities, and we work with crop insurance companies to provide for a grace period for the payment of unpaid insurance premiums. We're opening up emergency loans. We're working with the SBA to provide another avenue for credit. We've worked with the credit unions to get them engaged, and we've looked for ways in which we can encourage cover crops next year that might take some of the pressure off feed availability. So we looked at a broad range of things we could do at USDA absent a farm bill. But what we really wanted and what we really need is a five-year bill. In the five-year bill that passed the Senate, they call for margin protection, and the way it would work is if the differential between the milk price and the feed costs gets below $4 for a couple of months, it triggers payments from the government. In order to make sure that we don't create an incentive for continued oversupply, which we often confront in circumstances when prices go up, there was a mechanism to essentially control that supply and, in a sense, penalize folks for oversupply. A lot of controversy about that. Some people like it, some people don't. But I think what it is a recognition that we have to have a different system. Now, as I travel around the country, what I have noticed, Mr. Secretary, I bet you've noticed this too, dairymen and dairywomen have a hard time agreeing. You go to Vermont and they go, you know, we've really got it figured out here in New England and we don't really want or need anybody else to tell us how to do this. So I go, okay, well, we'll just go the Vermont way. And then you come to Wisconsin. Wisconsin says, well, you know, really, we're nearly in this business and the cheese business is kind of important. So we really kind of have this thing figured out. Just follow our lead. Say, oh, okay. And you go to New Mexico. They go, you know, I don't know what those people thinking in the Midwest or in the New England area, but you've got to trust us, and then you go out to California, and they absolutely have the right answer out there in California. Problem was, we have not had consensus. And that's made it difficult for us to get a program that would allow some stability and some protection. Now, I know that Senator Cole worked on the MILC program, and that has provided some help and assistance. It slowed down, if you will, the loss of facilities. We've lost about half of our dairy producers over the course of the last decade. So obviously something needs to be done. The question is, why don't we have a 2012 Farm Bill? How hard was it? Why didn't it happen? The Senate passed its bill in July. Strong bipartisan vote. Very strong bipartisan vote. Got more than 60 votes. About the only thing the Senate agreed on the last 2 years. Passed it over to the House. House Ag Committee under Chairman Lucas's leadership, Republican from Oklahoma, got his team together, got his committee together, worked on their version of a farm bill, passed it through committee on a strong bipartisan vote. In plenty of time for the House itself to take the bill up. House leadership, as Eric Cantor referred to it, put their finger on the pause button. And the question is, why? They offered two explanations for why we didn't get a bill done before September 30th. First, they said, well, we just don't have enough time. And candidly, folks, I'm here to tell you that I don't buy that notion. And the reason I don't buy it is because they scheduled 8 working days in September. 8. Last time I checked, September had 30 days. And then after setting only 8 working days, they left early. They left before they had used all 8 working days. So they clearly had enough time. Clearly had enough time. Then they said, well, we didn't have the votes, which would be a good reason not to have a bill, except that they never counted the votes. They never did what is called in Washington, D.C., a whipping of the vote. They never went to their colleagues and said, if we put a farm bill on the board, what would you do? Now, both Democrats and Republicans outside of leadership have done a count. And they concluded from their work that there would have been 230 to 240 votes to pass a farm bill, well beyond the 218 necessary to pass a farm bill. So you had the time and you had the votes. Now, the bill would have been clearly different than what the Senate passed, for sure. That's why you have conference committees to work out those differences, but you can't work them out until you have two versions. So the question is, why, if we had the time and had the votes, why didn't we do this? And I believe the reason it wasn't done is because they didn't want to have a full conversation about the depth of reductions that are forthcoming. The Senate passed a bill, and compared to 2008, would cost $23 billion less than the 2008 bill. They had reductions in nutrition. They had reductions in commodity programs and on some of the other programs. The House Ag Committee decided that they wanted a little deeper cut at around $34 billion. Again, same kind of mix, nutrition assistance, and a few cuts in commodity and conservation programs. House leadership had a much different number, and that number was reflected in the budget that the House passed on several occasions. They passed a budget that would call for $184 billion in cuts. 23, 34, 184. Now, 184 consisted of $134 billion of cuts in nutrition assistance programs and $50 billion of cuts to crop insurance, conservation, and commodity titles. That's a conversation they just didn't want to have at this time of year. And so we're faced now on October the 2nd with no MILC program, no checks forthcoming for dairy producers who are stuck. No export assistance programs. After having 4 of the best years of exports in the history of our country, the USDA is now without the tools to go out and promote trade shows or exchanges that would encourage more exports, leaving the export field, if you will, to Canada, to New Zealand, to Argentina, to Brazil, depending upon what the commodity is and who our competitor is. They now have an opportunity for the course of the next several months to have the playing field to themselves. There is no CRP signups that can take place. There are no grassland reserves or wetland reserve program signups that can take place. There's no beginning farmer and development program. See some of the FFA kids back in the back. This is a program that provides these young people an opportunity to get started in farming. We can't recruit new signees because we don't have the authority or the power. Yesterday, Secretary and I announced a series of specialty crop block grants and research initiatives. Wisconsin got 19 projects funded and 1 research project funded. Pretty significant stuff. But I can't do that from this point on because those programs have expired. And if over the course of the next several months, Congress doesn't get its act together and doesn't get a farm bill done, then you all know, and the Secretary knows what happens. we go to 1949 farm policy, and milk prices go up quite high. Now, Secretary and I have a little disagreement about how high they're going to go, but the range is somewhere between $38 and $50, a hundredweight. Now, that may sound like good news to some dairy producers, but the reality is that will have a rippling effect, as the Secretary so well articulated yesterday, throughout the entire farm community, and will impact consumer choice and have long-term impacts and effects, I think, Secretary, on dairy generally. People will begin to look at reformulating their products and making choices different than dairy. So we obviously don't want that. Now, how easy will it be for the House to do its work? Well, instead of the Farm Bill having its own day, its own time in the legislative calendar, its own capacity to have discussions about rural America for what rural America provides to this country, it's now wrapped up into a much larger conversation of a thing called sequester, which at the end of the year, if Congress doesn't act, there's an across-the-board cut that will take place in every single department of government. The USDA will be about 8.2%, every line item, pretty much, every program, almost all programs. Deficit reduction, you've heard about the fiscal cliff, and the fact that we have tax cuts that are expiring that many want to renew some or all of. All of that will require offsets and payments. And that will require discussion about a broad array of things that the government does that it will do less of. And compounding all of that is that there are some folks who don't want the Defense Department to be cut at all, which then puts a disproportionate amount on every other aspect of government. That's what's at stake here. That's what we face. So it creates a high level of stress, a high level of uncertainty. But the need for action is immediate. And so we're going to continue to encourage the House to get its work done, pass a bill, then work out whatever the differences are between the Senate and the House. And USDA will be prepared from day one to implement that new bill as quickly as possible. Now I'll finish with one notion that is often discussed. Well, we'll just extend the existing bill. Won't that work? That'll buy us some time. Several problems with that. Number one, an extension does not necessarily result in a continuation of the disaster programs that help livestock producers and specialty crop producers that expired last year in the 2008 Farm Bill. You'd have to retroactively reactivate them. There's a cost associated with that, and it would have to be offset by a cut in some other area. Secondly, an extension is more expensive than the Senate version that cuts $23 billion, the House Ag version that cuts $34 billion, or the House leadership view of $184 billion. So if they extend the bill, the current bill, I guarantee you there will be cuts within that extension. But we don't know what those cuts are, which creates uncertainty. So if you're going to go to your banker, try to convince them to provide you a loan for next year's crop or next year's operation, how do you tell that banker there's going to be an adequate safety net in place to assure the banker they're going to be repaid? Very difficult to do. And then finally, the baseline, which is sort of the foundation under which a farm bill is calculated by the Congressional Budget Office, the baseline would go down significantly, and we would start with less flexibility than if a bill were passed now. So an extension really is not an option. Plus, it doesn't provide the five-year certainty that we need. What has happened in rural America in the last couple of years is a great story. Record farm exports. Best 4 years of exports we've ever had. Record enrollment in conservation by the best stewards of our land and water, America's producers. Record expansion of local and regional food systems. tremendous expansion of farmers markets and community-supported agriculture and farm-to-school programs. It's now a multi-billion-dollar opportunity. Record production of biofuel and bio-based products. Translated, record farm income, lower unemployment in rural areas. Momentum building for a revived and revitalized rural economy. What is required to continue that momentum is a five-year bill. Serious stuff for dairy producers, serious stuff for farmers and ranchers and producers, serious stuff for rural America. So happy to try to answer questions, but you have to understand I don't have a lot of answers. I have a lot of questions of why things didn't get done. Don't have a lot of answers about what's going to happen, but we'll do everything I can to answer your questions as best I can in the time remaining. So with that, the Secretary and I will take a sip of our chocolate milk and open it up for questions.
Secretary told me you were not a bashful group. It takes one brave soul to start this conversation. And if you don't, I've got a 45-minute boring speech.
In the back. Not always boring. Jim's in the back. Back, way back.
Mr. Secretary, Jim Dickrell with Dairy Today magazine. There is a counterproposal known as the Goodlatte Amendment that would not require supply management in the Dairy Security Act portion of the Farm Bill. Would the administration support that Goodlatte Amendment if that was passed by Congress?
You know, I have not had a full chance to analyze the impact of this, but let me just say that there is not as much support for that amendment as it might appear. Colin Peterson is the ranking member of the House Ag Committee, is strongly in favor of what the Senate passed and what the House Ag Committee passed. I suspect he would not look favorably on that amendment, which leads me to believe that it may have a very difficult time getting through the House. The reality is that this bill will always require and should require a bipartisan vote. It's not going to be a situation where one party can provide the votes. That's why when they did the whip count on the farm bill, they found there were about 250 votes for it, about 130 Republicans, about 120 Democrats. There was strong support for this. So that tells me that that amendment's not likely to be successful. I will tell you what we do favor. We do favor a different system than the one we have today. We cannot be willing to accept the notion that we've lost half our dairy producers in the last decade. We can't accept the idea that these price spikes in a global marketplace are too steep and too quick, do not give dairy producers enough time to recover. We've got to create a broader price band. We've got to create greater stability, less volatility. And we're going to be in favor of a system that does that. We'd like to see consensus. Because it's been so difficult to get. There seems to be some degree of consensus on the along the margin piece of what the Senate proposed, some questions about the supply side piece, and maybe that will have to be tweaked or amended to satisfy folks that it's not onerous. But the reality is every time we've had good prices, what happens is I say to myself as a dairy producer, I got good prices. I can produce a little bit more. My neighbor's not going to do that. He'll stay where he is, and I'll get the benefit. And then the secretary over there says, you know, I think I can increase production just a little bit because my neighbor's not going to figure this out. All of a sudden, we both do it. We have overproduction, and prices drop. I mean, we just have to figure out some way of creating greater stability on the supply side and some mechanism to ensure that if that differential gets below $4 and people just can't make it, that we're there to help. Let me just tell you one thing about this FFA organization. These young people, I think you all understand this, but they are a great group of young people, and I've had a chance to meet with many of them, and they've been very instructive in terms of their concerns about the Farm Bill and how they believe credit is an issue for beginning farmers. And one of the reasons why the Senate bill increases beginning farmer and development programs is in part because of FFA's advocacy. So appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. Good morning. Kayla Heck from Wisconsin FFA, serving as state FFA president this year. As we represent the 19,000 members here in Wisconsin FFA that are looked as the future of agriculture, and we talk about rural America and having rural values, and we're addressed with these concerns of what will be next in agriculture and production agriculture, and how do we tell our story, and the concerns that we get from the public, how do we tell that story, and how can we pass on those values?
Well, first of all, how articulate was that? You know, it's very intimidating. Yeah, it's very intimidating, very intimidating. Look, there is a great story to tell here. I mean, there is a fabulous story to tell. And it's a cutting-edge, modern, out-front story of agriculture being an extraordinarily productive arm of the American economy during a tough recession that we experienced. Agriculture was a shining star, helped us get through a tough time without a much deeper and longer lasting recession. So agriculture gets some credit for that. But the enormous capacity, we haven't maxed out in our productivity. We're still making significant gains in crop and livestock production. We have this extraordinary export capacity. The world understands and appreciates nobody does agriculture better, safer, with higher quality and higher value than America. So they want what we can produce. And with free trade agreements that have been finalized, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if we can make sure we get through the dairy part of it, which is not going to be easy, opens up hundreds of millions of new consumers. So production, agriculture, and exports, the future is bright. It also is a job creator, and I think that's a piece of what we need to continue to emphasize, that it's not just about farm income, it's about your neighbor's job. You send more overseas, somebody's got to package it, process it, ship it, truck it, store it. Those are all jobs. Then when you combine that with the extraordinary story of America's producers being great stewards of the land and using conservation in a new and creative way to produce more income opportunities by essentially farmers linking up with regulated enterprises like power companies and basically selling or the power company purchasing conservation practices that allow that power company to meet some regulatory responsibility they have for the environment, which the farmer can do through conservation practices. It's called an ecosystem market. It's already operating in a lot of places around the country. New opportunities. Link that to what the folks in Wisconsin understand and appreciate, which is outdoor recreation pays. Expand hunting and fishing and hiking and biking opportunities. Bring those tourism dollars into small towns. That rolls around many times in an economy. Helps to employ people. Combine that with the local and regional food system movement, which is allowing young people to get into the farming business without having to purchase 1,000 acres of land and a lot of expensive equipment, but still creating a personal relationship between the producer and the consumer, a direct relationship with no third party, negotiated prices, don't have to worry about what's going on at the Chicago Board of Trade. You develop a personal relationship as long as you can provide the quantity and the quality that school needs or that hospital needs or that farmer's market needs, that's a cash opportunity. And then combine that with what I saw yesterday at the Forest Product Lab here in Madison. The ability to take nanotechnology, in which you essentially reduce a tree to its subatomic particles, and reformulate those particles so that you will have Kevlar, the vests that our military wear, made from wood, stronger and more protection and far lighter. It won't be fiberglass, it'll be fiber wood, and your car will be made from it. And that will be with a soybean tire that's being produced at the Ford Motor Innovation Center along with the bioplastic that's being made in some of their other universities, together with the soy foam seat that you're sitting on, all of a sudden every automobile is plant and crop based. Extraordinary job opportunities and creating a market for what is waste product. It transforms the rural economy, because these biomass facilities have to be dotting the landscape because of the bulk of biomass. And it transforms the American economy, because we get back into business of making stuff again that the rest of the world hasn't figured out how to do, which allows us to export. So if I were a young person, the farm of the future, one of the most exciting, transformative opportunities the country has. We have to market that. We have to market that. And we have to convince our friends in the media, not the farm broadcasters, but the other media, that there's a lot going on here that's way cool, that is really innovative, and deserves a lot more attention than it gets. And that's a message that I convey wherever I go. I tell the story, Secretary, they have these dinners in Washington, D.C. You see them on, you see them on the tube. It's like the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You know, they bring comedians in. And I guarantee you, folks, three-quarters of the people in that room do not want to be in that room. But they feel like they have to be there. So I was in that room, and I was sitting with the Time Magazine people. And I'm sure that they looked at George Clooney at the table two down, and so several other movie stars, and they're thinking, I got the Secretary of Agriculture. But I had him for an hour and a half, and so what I did is I said, you guys do this Person of the Year thing on the cover. I said, you ought to have the American farmer be the Person of the Year. They looked at me. I said, let me tell you about what's going on in farming. So I then spent the next hour and a half talking about all this whiz-bang stuff that's going on. At the end of it, they said, well, you got him in the top five. So I don't know. Maybe not on the cover, but we're getting them to understand. Then along comes the drought. And people come to me at the beginning of this, and they say, it's going to be horrible. We're not going to have any crops. I said, well, let's wait and see. We just don't know. And we don't know until the harvest takes place, the beans get counted, and the kernels get stored. We just don't know. Amazing story here. Even with the drought, likely to have the eighth largest corn crop in the history of the country. Now, why is that? How is that possible when there's no water? Technology, new techniques embraced by farmers, conserve the water, don't use as much water, yields a little better than people expected. Now, it was a horrible year, tough year, very hard on livestock and dairy and specialty crop producers, but nevertheless, better than anybody in the mainstream media thought it would be. And it's, again, American farmers. This happens in any other country, you got nothing. And then on top of that, farmers smart enough to have risk management tools that they use so that the economic impact on their families and on their communities and on their state is not as great as it would have been in 88 or 72 or 54 or 34, 32 when we had droughts before. So, look, you have an amazing opportunity. And I just am very jealous of the fact that you're your age and I'm my age.
Where the word ethanol is not a very popular word. And that's that sentiment is echoed through many states where dairy producers live and work and what they tell me. And I'm wondering what you see, what your opinion is of how U.S. ethanol policy will look going forward.
Well, where I come from, ethanol is not a four-letter word. It's however many letters it is.
But there are 49 or 45 or 48 states.
Well, let's talk about that. Because I think ethanol gets somewhat of a bad rap. Obviously you're going to say, well, he comes from Iowa, he comes from the Midwest. What is he supposed to say? He's expected to say that. But I'm going to make the case. Let me see what you think. First of all, For far too long, our crop producers were receiving far below what they needed to have a decent living. And so the opportunity to, as they increase productivity, to find out creative ways to use the productivity became important. At the same time, the country was concerned about its over-reliance on foreign oil. So the thought was, can we do something with our agricultural production that goes beyond food and feed and fiber and adds to it fuel? How could we do that? Well, corn was probably the simplest and quickest way and the most efficient way to start that to conversation because of the science. So we started an ethanol industry. First of all, it has provided an opportunity, as corn production has increased dramatically, 300% in my lifetime, it has provided an opportunity so that we don't necessarily have extraordinarily low prices that make it far, far more difficult for smaller producers to stay in business. Secondly, it gave producers the ability not only to profit from production but also processing, because many of these ethanol production facilities were cooperatively owned by farmers. So it gave them another income opportunity. Third, it was a job creator in a part of the country where we had been losing a lot of our young people because there simply were not the jobs. So now today, nearly 400,000 people are directly or indirectly connected and employed in that industry. We began to produce this, and we found that there were some environmental benefits. As you know, in California, you had water issues with MPDE, and ethanol basically resolved those water issues, didn't create the challenge to water quality as an additive. And then we found that it actually began to reduce the cost of gas. Several studies. You can pick one that's the most conservative, or you can pick the one that I like. The one that's conservative says, at a minimum, we're spending 25 cents a gallon less for our gas than we would otherwise be spending because we have a biofuel industry. The one I like says it could be as high as $1.37 a gallon. So there's savings to the consumer. Reducing our reliance on foreign oil. Last 3 years, as we've increased biofuel production, we also have seen a decline in foreign oil use from 62% of our oil being imported to 45%. So we've become a more energy secure country as a result, less reliant on foreign oil. So those are the benefits: jobs, higher incomes, lower gas costs, environmental benefits, and reduction of our reliance on foreign oil. Now, folks say, well, it's taking food away from us. It's taking feed away from us. The problem with that notion is the percentage of corn that is currently being used for feed or for exports is essentially the same as it has been. And the reason it's the same is because we've increased productivity, and we've just taken that excess and applied it to fuel production. Now, it's not just fuel that's produced. So we hear a lot of people say, well, I've got 40% of the corn crop is being used for fuel production. Well, it's not really 40%. Because a third of it comes back in DDGs, dry distillers grain, which is used by the livestock industry as a feed supplement and additive, and some would argue allows less feed to be used as a result. So it's less than 40%. It's more like 27%. All right, so all of those benefits have to be taken into consideration. Now, the industry comes and says, we really shouldn't have to rely on corn. And we agree. So we're moving away from our reliance on corn by identifying alternative feedstocks that don't necessarily compete with feed or food needs. So we have financed recently at USDA 9 separate biorefineries, bioprocessing facilities, that use corn stover, that use algae, use switchgrass, woody biomass, agricultural waste, municipal waste. And we're going to use those facilities to learn how more efficiently to produce. Well, one's in Florida, one's in Mississippi, there are two in Iowa, there's one in Oregon, there's one in New Mexico, just off the top of my head. In addition, we're paying farmers to produce miscanthus and camelina and other alternative feedstocks through the BCAP program to encourage farmers to begin transitioning some of their non-productive land to a more productive use. At the same time we're doing this, the Navy comes along and says, you know, we are really concerned about our over-reliance on oil, and particularly foreign oil, to fuel our jets and our ships. And given the nature of what's happening in the world today, where we have to have a military that's extraordinarily flexible, that can move on a dime, that can move quickly because of a terrorist situation, we really do not want to have to be reliant on a source of oil that could be compromised in a moment's notice. So they come to us and say, can you help us, USDA and Department of Energy, develop a drop-in aviation fuel that does not compete with food, that uses non-food feedstocks? So we've put together $500 million, and we're going to help build three or four facilities that use, again, non-food feedstocks to produce a drop-in aviation fuel and marine fuel. The Navy will buy it. USDA will buy down the cost of the feedstock so it's competitive. The commercial aviation industry is really interested in this because they're facing emissions issues in Europe, which they cannot meet with the current jet fuel mixture. So they will use this biofuel. So we have a farm to fly initiative, because Honeywell, Boeing, United Airlines, and others are very interested in this. So it creates.
What's this program called?
Well, it's I don't know if it's called any. It's a opportunity for the Navy to essentially meet 50% of its fuel needs through biofuel. And the Air Force is doing something similar. The Army is doing something similar. For the benefit of the press here, best press conference I ever had, Mr. Secretary, was with the Secretary of the Navy, and we were announcing this. We had a tank in the back, and the media was here, and the tank turret would just go back and forth. Very intimidating. So you see, this industry is creating innovation. And then from that, there are a series of co-products and byproducts that are going to be created that fuel this bio-based economy. So in Wisconsin, just right here in Madison, you've got a company taking corn cobs and reformulating the molecules from corn cobs and turning it into plastic bottles that Coca-Cola is interested in using to build 10 billion bottles a year to, you know, and it's 100% renewable, 100% recyclable, and 100% plant-based. So this is the exciting thing I was talking about. This is an extraordinary new opportunity here. So rather than being critical of it, let's give it enough time to move away from this debate, which I think in some cases is somewhat misleading because not all the facts are known, and move to a situation where we're doing all of these great things, helping to promote the rural economy. Now, last thing I would say is EPA's got a request before it to change the renewable fuel standard. There are two problems with the request. One is, economists will say that it will do very little to change the price of corn. The theory is, well, if we get away with the renewable fuel standard, somehow the price of corn will come substantially down, and it will be a lot less expensive to feed livestock. The problem is that's not the case, because corn is now sort of a global issue here. And that corn price is likely to stay relatively high. Some have estimated, if the waiver is granted, that it might impact and affect corn prices by a quarter, 25 cents. I don't think that's going to make a lot of difference in the scheme of things. Secondly, and probably as importantly, or maybe more importantly, the petroleum industry says, you know what, even if you do away with the renewable fuel standard, we're still going to use this ethanol because we like the octane it provides, and it's a good additive. So it's not necessarily going to reduce the production of ethanol. The key here, from my perspective, in terms of helping people in the short term, is having the Congress do its work, pass a food, farm, and jobs bill so we can provide cash assistance to these producers who are strapped and let them ride through this difficult time. But that's one man's opinion. Yes, sir? Can you wait for the microphone so everybody can hear you, Pete?
Pete Harden from the Milkweed. If one includes 2012, two out of the past 4 years have been the worst years in modern history for dairy farmers' bottom lines. For the first 8 months of 2012, using USDA data on all milk prices and dairy production costs, dairy farmers have collectively lost $10 billion. That's equal to roughly 40% of their gross cash flow. That's equal to the now depressed value of all the milking cows, all the milk cows in the country. A great portion of these losses relate to higher prices for grain and forages due to, in part, drought. Your office in the past month plus has received over 1,000 petitions seeking emergency hearing price relief because milk prices on a parity basis are far below grain prices. Now, short term, the 608C18 hearing process could be viewed as a Band-Aid, although it's a medium-term Band-Aid. But what's your opinion on a longer-term change in the milk pricing system that would factor in the costs of production, particularly grain and regional grain and forage costs, when efficient costs can be measured and calculated?
Okay. The petition you refer to is a highly technical process that we have to follow, and the petition itself has to be quite extensive and comprehensive. It has to not just simply say, hey, there's a problem, fix it. It has to say, hey, there's a problem, here's the solution. The petitions that we have seen, at least that I've seen, don't really rise to the technical level they need to rise to in order for me to be able to take the action that folks want. That's just a proviso. On the second part of your question, I agree. There has to be a different system. And I think I've indicated that in my opening remarks, that there's too much volatility and not enough time between episodes to allow folks to rebound. We had a pretty good year in between those tough years, but if we'd had two or three good years, then it makes it a little bit easier, obviously, for somebody to withstand a tough year that's drought-related. We don't have that time span. If you look at the price span, you're going to see substantial peaks and valleys and a very narrow time frame between those. So you do need a process that stretches it out. Now, what's been proposed in the Senate Ag Committee bill, what Colin Peterson's been working on with a number of dairy producers, is an attempt to do what you've asked be done, to take a look at price, to take a look at cost of production feed, and when that differential goes below $4 for 2 months or more, relief gets kicked in, and resources are provided to those producers. Now, that could essentially break the federal piggy bank, so there has to be some capacity to ensure that this doesn't go on for years and years and years. So that's where you get into the supply side piece of this, which is controversial. But there's no question, I think there's consensus on the fact that there needs to be some kind of margin insurance, some kind of mechanism to Well, you know, that you reflect basically the difference, which is frustrating to people like me, that the dairy folks do not have consensus on this, okay? And that makes it really difficult to do anything. You got to have consensus to move people. And if you have some people say it's got to be price, and some people say it's insurance, and some people say, just, you know, do this with the marketing order or do that with the marketing order or do this with purchases, you end up essentially not having any action at all because there's not a political consensus. At least there's a consensus. You may not agree with it, but there is a consensus in the Senate on the insurance side. There appears to be some consensus on the House Ag side of this mechanism. Now, not consensus about the supply side piece of this, but that could be worked out. But it is at least a better system than we have today. Because right now, I have no way of helping people, really. A formal petition gets filed with all the data that's required, and that's something we can consider. But right now, I have no MILC program. I have no capacity within USDA to do what I did in 2009 to provide help and assistance to get people through a tough time. It's very frustrating. And that's why I'm irritated with the House for not getting its work done on the farm bill, because at least we would have had movement. We would have had some idea what was next. I can't tell you what's next. I don't know. Is it $23 billion? Is it $34 billion? Or is it $184 billion? Or some higher number? Because somebody wants a tax cut or somebody wants a department not to have to contribute to deficit reduction. Look, folks, we at Ag understand we got to do our part for deficit reduction. Don't want anybody walking out here thinking we don't want to do our part. We reform crop insurance, save $4 or $5 billion, put that to deficit reduction. We understand we're going to be dealing with less money in the department. We're going through a massive process called the administrative services process. We've had to close offices. It's controversial. Our workforce has been shrunk. You know, we've reduced travel and conferences and all that kind of stuff. We're doing all that business. Reducing the number of cell phones, cars, et cetera, in an effort to try to be responsible. But I just don't want to have to do more than my fair share. I don't think rural America should have to do more than its fair share. And I think that's a concern I have about why there wasn't action on the farm bill. I think somebody's going to ask us to do more than our fair share. And that doesn't seem right to me. Yes, sir. No questions about replacement reps.
No. Hi, I'm Brett Iverson. I'm a teacher and coach, and I wanted to thank you for your support of the Good Food Revolution, getting good, healthy food into schools. And I also, as a coach, though, I've been dealing with some of the students with the amount of calories. Is there any way that the USDA can allow some students to have more calories, more butter, cheese, Parmesan cheese, like on their spaghetti and things like that? Because some of those restrictions are they're not allowing that in the school lunch. So,
our program is designed to respond to 32 million youngsters who basically have school lunch, or 12 million or so that have school breakfast. And so our job is to essentially establish kind of a standard. We went to the experts and we said, for elementary, middle school, high school kids, what should the standard be? And we knew that there were some schools that were providing food to youngsters where the calories were extraordinarily far beyond what most ordinary kids would need, notwithstanding the fact that there's going to be a 235-pound linebacker that's going to need a little bit more. So our job, create the standard. Went to the experts. They came back to us and said, here's what you need to do. The calorie differential on average between what's happening this year and what happened last year is somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 50 calories. It's not that much difference. What's different is what makes up those calories. And from the experts and from the direction from Congress, obviously more fruits, vegetables, low-fat dairy, whole grains, a little bit less sodium, sugar, and fat content, all designed to provide a more nutritious meal. Elementary school kids are having no problems with this. Middle school kids, high school kids are having a problem with it because it represents something significantly different than what they've had before. We'll work with schools. We got a snack program that they could establish. To date, no one has asked for the additional assistance and help from the snack program, but that's something we could more than happy to work with school districts on. Parents obviously have the capacity. You know, if they're not satisfied, they can provide the youngsters the resources to purchase more in the a la carte line, or they can pack a snack, or they can give the youngster a little extra cash if they feel that they're not getting enough. I know that my kids, when they came home from school, always had a snack. I mean, I don't think this is anything new. And the fact that some kids are turning their nose up at fruits and vegetables, that's not new either. My young son refused to eat broccoli. I don't sort of blame him, because the first time he had broccoli, there was a little worm working its way through the broccoli, and that sort of soured him on broccoli for a while. But, you know, that happens. But here's the point. The point of it, the larger point is, a third of our kids are obese or at risk of being obese. We don't have enough kids to satisfy the military for all volunteer army. We have the enormous health care costs that are associated with obesity and people being out of shape. And those costs are going to be borne by all of us. And the kids won't perform as well. So there's flexibility in the system. There's a snack program that could be instituted. Parents can help. And people have to understand that our job isn't necessarily to try to provide a menu for every single individual child. That would require 32 million different menus. Our job is basically to say, you know, on average, on standard, this is what you need. And this is what makes up what you need. And if you want more, you got the a la carte line. If you want more, you got the vending machine. If you want more, you pack a snack. Or if you want more, the school district sets up a snack program. And hopefully they'll use nutritious snacks to supplement. So, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to deal with this. Yes, sir.
Mike Ivey with the Capital Times, part of that mainstream media. Your boss is coming to town on Thursday after the debate, and will make his pitch to Wisconsin, which apparently is still in play if the president's going to come and speak here. How might a Romney-Ryan presidency affect the ag community versus 4 more years of Obama?
First of all, I wasn't sure which boss you were talking about. Well, you know, I actually, one of the things I learned, you know, when you're a governor, you kind of think you're the boss. When you go into a secretary position, you kind of think you're the boss of the department. And you find out there's the president, there's Congress, and then there's the OMB. Yeah, I fear OMB more than I fear the other two. It's an interesting group. Anyway, that's a very difficult question to answer in a way that doesn't sound that I'm overly partisan. I will do my best. I think the best, I think right now there are two fundamental differences that can be pointed out. Representative Ryan was the architect of the House budget that called for $184 billion of reductions. And you'll notice that when I talked about this, I talked about the House budget. I didn't talk about the Ryan budget, trying to be sensitive to this. But he is the architect of it, and that is calling for $50 billion of reductions, not in nutrition programs is much the conversation, but actually in crop insurance subsidies, conservation, and commodity title. $50 billion just in that section of the farm bill, compared to $23 billion total for the Senate, $34 billion total for the House Ag Committee. So that's a significant difference that will impact and affect farmers in their pocketbook. Secondly, there are alternative income opportunities that are available to farmers, and one of them is renewable energy. And a lot of farmers are renting out land for windmills, particularly in the Midwest where we have pretty strong wind currents. Governor Romney believes that the wind tax credit doesn't have to be extended. The president disagrees, and there is some indication that if it's not extended, the wind energy industry will be at a disadvantage, jobs will be lost, and that will impact and affect how many windmills are placed on farms, particularly in the Midwest. I think there's not likely to be a whole lot of difference in terms of trade. I think both parties, both candidates, if you will, understand the importance of trade. I think there's an understanding of outdoor recreation and on both sides, so I don't know that there's going to be a lot of change there. There may be some less interest in the local and regional food system, but, you know, if people realize it's a multi-billion dollar industry and it's expanding and growing and it's providing an entry point for younger folks, that may, too, not be a point of difference. You know, I think the Romney Ryan folks are probably more supportive of the oil industry as the answer. I think the president's view is all of the above, and that would include more focus on bio-based. But I'd say the differences right now are in how deep the cuts are going to be and whether or not you support the wind energy industry. That would be my best answer to that. Yes, sir.
Gordon, Secretary Manny Vasquez with Senator Ron Johnson's office. Senator Johnson expressed concern over the high percentage of SNAP funding included in the Farm Bill, the formerly known as food stamps. And he suggested to have a separate vote, one on SNAP and one on sort of a true Farm Bill. What's your opinion, without necessarily talking about the pros and cons of SNAP, what's your opinion on having a separate vote or sort of separating the Farm Bill into two separate categories to vote?
Well, I want to follow the prescription of your question, and I don't want to get into the pros and cons of SNAP, but I think it is important you and I have a different opinion about whether or not SNAP constitutes part of the farm program. And here's why. If you trace where money goes when it's spent at a grocery store or spent at a restaurant, and you trace it through the supply chain, what you find is that 14% of the food dollar in the country ultimately gets in the pocket of the farmer. And it makes sense, obviously, if more is consumed, then more has to be produced and sold, and that stabilizes prices and farmers benefit. So as you construct a farm safety net, you have to construct something that encourages consumption during difficult times when people may have to cut back. So the SNAP program is in part designed to provide some assistance in that period to maintain that 14 cents going in the farmer's pocket. So when you talk about reducing it by $134 billion, you're really talking about $18 billion of farm income. So I think it's important to put it in that context. There is a division, I think, in this country between folks who live in urban and suburban areas and folks who live in rural areas. I think the folks in rural areas have perhaps a slightly better appreciation for where their food comes from and for all of the risks associated and the difficulties in producing the food. That may not be front and center if you live in the middle of a city or in a suburb. You may think of food only in the context of whether you've got a grocery store nearby, or if that grocery store has a broad array of diversity of what you want or doesn't, or there's a particular price for something you do like that's increased or decreased. That's your mentality. You're not really thinking about how does drought affect my neighbor. So you live in a small town, you know that drought's affecting your neighbor and you're concerned about it because you see your neighbor at church or you see him in the insurance agency or the post office. Because of that, when you propose a quote-unquote farm bill that talks about providing help for crop insurance purchases or helps somebody install a conservation practice or invests in a wastewater treatment facility in a small town or expands broadband to a small community or promotes exports, all of which is supported by a farm bill, or provides research dollars for the local university, that city folk may not understand what's in it for them. And so as a representative of those folks, you may think, well, why do I even care about this? Well, what's in it for me? And you may have a harder time actually accumulating the votes necessary to get a farm bill through the process. So when you combine a nutrition assistance program with those farm programs, you get, in a sense, the best of both worlds because you get the smaller community, the rural members of Congress who represent rural areas, they understand directly what's at stake here. They explain to their colleagues that this nutrition assistance program is going to help your people in inner city or in suburbs where there may be some difficulties because of a recession. You know, it's important, folks, to point out who it is who gets SNAP. Sometimes we forget that. We think must be all people on welfare. 8% of the people receiving SNAP are on cash welfare. 8%. 92% are senior citizens, people with disabilities, children, or those who are actually working. They may have a part-time job. They may have a full-time job that doesn't pay them much, but they're working. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're playing by the rules. A lot of those people live in cities, suburbs. So that combination gives you enough votes to get it through the process. And I think if you were to separate it, you might end up getting a lot of support for the nutrition programs because there are a disproportionate number of people who represent cities and suburbs, and you may have a hard time gathering the votes for the programs that the folks in the rural areas need because rural areas only represent 16% of America's population. That means 84% is represented by somebody else. So I think that's the concern, is whether or not you'd be able to cobble the votes together to get everything done. And that would require a better understanding on the part of the folks in the city and the suburbs about what agriculture really is, and that's why we've encouraged the development of the Farmer and Rancher Alliance, which is designed to begin sending a single message about agriculture so we do a better job of connecting people in cities and suburbs to their food supply so they have a greater appreciation for the people who produce it. Yes, sir.
And Mr. Secretary, I'm Randy Gilbertson. I'm representing represents the 11 tribes here in Wisconsin. And I just was curious as to what you would like to see in a farm bill in regard to providing particularly conservation assistance to the traditionally underserved clientele of the department.
We have proposed and put together a thing called Strike Force. And the reason we put this together was because we recognized that 90% of the persistently poor areas of this country are in rural areas. A lot of people, when they think of poverty, their immediate picture is inner city. But the reality is the persistently poor live in those small towns, and some of them live on reservations and settlements. So we put together Strike Force because what has happened in the past is we've been able to say, well, we got programs. The problem is those people have not been able to access those programs because in some cases they don't know the rules. Or in some cases the process is pretty complicated, and unless you kind of know how to play the game, you're not going to be particularly successful. So our theory was if we could identify places that have been persistently poor based on data, we would basically assemble a team at USDA of experts in rural development, NRCS, farm service, and we would actually go down to those counties, and instead of a, here we are from the government, trust us where there isn't much trust, we would align ourselves with a community organization, community building organization, someone that had roots in the community. And we would work with them to identify the needs and work with them to ensure success in meeting those needs through our programs so that people would learn how to play the game, they'd have some success, and they'd, you know, build on that success. So we started in three states. We started in Georgia. We started in Mississippi. We started in Arkansas. And we actually had some success. We've expanded it in the Southwest to include a number of Hispanic and tribal areas. We're now moving up to North Carolina and Virginia. We haven't gotten up to the north of the Mason-Dixon line because a lot of the persistently poor areas, it's an amazing map. If you see where the free and reduced lunch numbers are, I mean, it's just incredible. You draw a line, Mason-Dixon line, there's a lot of poverty in those southern tier states. So that's where our focus has been. And in fact, just today I read the quarterly report of the Strike Force. And I can tell you that increased numbers of NRCS grants are going out. Increased loans are being made to producers under FSA. Increased rural development projects are being funded. People are beginning to see success. So we're going to continue to do that. And we're going to continue to monitor and keep track, keep score. What we have done is in every county where we've had a lot of claims against the department in the past for discrimination, we've actually had our FSA folks and our rural development folks tell us what the percentage of socially disadvantaged producers are in that county, socially disadvantaged people are in that county. We're now then comparing that percentage to the number of loans. So in other words, if Brad's got a county that's got 15% socially disadvantaged producers, but only 2% of his loans go out to socially disadvantaged folks, we're going to be talking to Brad about, hey, what's going on there? Same thing with Pat and NRCS. So we're attempting to make sure we're getting the support to where it can have a significant impact. And people are responding favorably to this. And the reason for this, in case people are thinking, well, you know, golly, they're always getting all the help, and we're going to end up paying out couple billion dollars in claims for discrimination that occurred in the 1980s, 1990s, where people didn't get their help because they were black or they were Native American or they were Hispanic or they were women. And my view is I don't want to have to spend those kind of monies in the future. Seems that's, you know, we shouldn't be discriminating. We shouldn't be exposing ourselves to that liability. We should be getting the job done right to begin with. And if we do, then we don't have liabilities and we can redirect those resources in helping people. So that's kind of where we are. Yes, sir.
Mike Geldy, I'm a senior in dairy science here at the UW. You touched a little bit about helping young individuals get into production agriculture. what emphasis is being put on individuals like me who are interested in science and agricultural research?
Well, we have we've encouraged the ag committees to start thinking a little bit more strongly about the importance of investing in research. Ag productivity is directly tied to ag research. The more you research, the more productive you become. It's pretty history will tell you that. We're faced with an enormous challenge here in the next 40 years, your lifetime. We're going to have to increase food production globally by 70% to meet the increase in global population. We're going to have to do that with more extreme weather conditions, as we've seen recently. We're going to do it with energy needs. We're going to do it with folks who are not particularly productive now, who have to learn new ways and don't have things like extension and don't have great university systems. So it's an enormous challenge. So it's very important for the United States to continue investing in ag research so we can continue to be more productive. I mean, the story of productivity in this country is absolutely nothing short of amazing. Part of the farm bill that went through the Senate, another frustration I have, and part of what went through the House Ag Committee is a new opportunity to leverage resources. In the health arena, we have foundations. So the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, they have the capacity to bring in private sector resources and leverage it with public sector dollars. It stretches the money. It creates greater weight behind research projects. Forest Service has that, but the ag community generally does not. So we are suggesting and suggested strongly that they create that kind of mechanism to give us that capacity. And that's in the farm bills that are going through the process. That should have significant help. That should make a big difference. Secondly, we're trying to make sure that we continue to support the land-grant university system with the formula grants, but also create a sense of competition so that universities begin to collaborate and cooperate more effectively with each other. Now, they do a good job, but they can do an even better job, and we're seeing that. We're seeing one university supported by six or seven different universities making applications for our National Institute of Food and Agriculture grants on a competitive basis. And so we're getting a bigger bang, if you will, for our buck. And we're creating grants, multiple-year grants, and larger-sized grants in some key areas so that it's not just a one-shot deal because, you know, we hire you for a year, then the funding runs out, what do you do? But if you know you got a 2 or 3 year gig here, you'd establish a relationship, you establish your credentials with that university, they find the next project for you to be involved in as opposed to telling you that, you know, you got to go to a different place. So those are some of the things that we're doing. And just to emphasize the power of this, when I talked to my staff about this, I said, well, you know, the reason why the health folks get all this money is that they're out there talking about curing cancer. You know, who's not to like that idea? And one of our staff folks looked at me and said, Secretary, it's not about curing cancer. It's about preventing cancer. With proper nutrition and proper research, we could, in theory, prevent cancer. So now what's happening in universities across the country, I was at Ohio State. They've got a tomato juice product. You drink the tomato juice, it's a cure for prostate cancer. They got a little blueberry candy that you suck on, and it's a treatment for oral cancer. It's unbelievable. So in our lifetime, your lifetime for sure, maybe not mine, but in your lifetime, you're going to go into a grocery store, and you're not just going to pick out a fruit or a vegetable because you like it. You're going to pick out a fruit or vegetable because it's specifically designed to deal with arthritis or diabetes or some condition that you have. I mean, that's the enormous capacity. Again, back to the earlier question about why should young people get excited about this? My Lord, you can change the world. You have the power to change the world here. So deep commitment to research, deep commitment to research. America can't get back in the business of making, creating, and innovating unless it continues to discover things that haven't been discovered. And if you go to the Forest Products Lab, you'll see some phenomenal things with nanotechnology. I mean, it's amazing what can be done with a piece of wood. I mean, I had no idea. Yes? Okay, thanks, Malcolm. You're one of two.
Good. Just bridging off of our State FFA president and the young man going to UW-Madison. I work for Wisconsin Farm Bureau, and I work with several farmers that, you know, I'm kind of in this little circle where I'm all agriculture friends. And when you meet consumers and they have all these questions about genetically engineered food and see all these horror movies that HSUS is putting out and hear what Chipotle is saying, how do we end the mudslinging and how do we tell the good story of agriculture? It's so hard when I feel like I am such a small voice, and how can we be so much more powerful to be more proactive instead of reactive?
That's a really great question. It's one we're grappling with now, and that's why the Farm and Rancher Alliance, of which the Farm Bureau is an important component, is so important, because it brings together almost all of agriculture to convey a more positive message about agriculture and to educate people about where their food comes from and the steps that farmers and producers take to ensure that it's safe, to ensure that it's high quality, to ensure that it's not going to do damage to their family. Okay, that has not been happening in the past. I don't know about you, Secretary, but you know, different groups come in and it's always a conversation within agriculture. You know, livestock guys come in and they say, you know, that ethanol industry was, you know, we don't like that ethanol industry. Ethanol industry comes in and says, well, the livestock guys, why don't they understand what we're doing for them? You know, and the big guys are always squawking about the little guys, and the little guys are always squawking about the big guys. And it's a conversation within agriculture that's not particularly helpful. Now we're shifting. It's not that conversation within agriculture. It's agriculture coming together with a single message. Why? Because the number of producers in this country is a relatively small number. The USDA started 150 years ago. When it started, 90% of our population was connected in one way, shape, or form to the farm. Back to your question about why we separate the SNAP program from the rest of the farm programs, we wouldn't have to do that in 1862, because everybody knew what was going on in a farm. Today, if you take the most expansive definition of farmer, the one we use at USDA when we do our ag census, anybody that produces more than $1,000 worth of stuff is a quote-unquote farmer. 2.3 million people. So we got a population of 305 million. We went from 90% to less than 2%. Well, less than 1%. All right? Of that 2.3 million, 1.3 are what we refer to as residential farmers. They have an orchard in the back. They got a little plot in the back. They got a little garden in the back. They got on the farmer's market. They sell a little something. You know, they're not making any money off of farming, but boy, they really enjoy it. God bless them. But in terms of providing the food for the country, 1.3 out of the 2.3, at least a million left. Of the million left, about 600,000 to 700,000 produce less than $250,000 worth of stuff. They're what, if you walked out on the street and said, hey, describe for me what a family farmer is, that's probably who a lot of people would describe, even though all of these people are family farmers. 85% of what is produced that we consume is produced by the balance of those farmers, 200,000 to 300,000 folks. Less than one-tenth of 1%. The moral of this is that farmers, there aren't enough farmers to be fussing with each other when you ought to be talking to the other 99% about what you do and how you do it and why you do it and the benefits that they get. Benefit number one, we are a food secure nation. Do not take that for granted. We can produce, in a sense, everything we need to survive. That is not true in other countries. China's got 60 million farmers. So 200,000 to 300,000 produce 85% of what we grow. China's got 60 million farmers. They can't come even close to producing what they need to feed their people. They're not happy about that. They're not food secure. We are. Huge national security advantage. Second advantage, we go into a grocery store, we go through the checkout line, we come out with an extraordinary diversity of food, and we actually have more in our pocket from our paycheck as a percentage than virtually anybody else in the world. Because we only spend 7-8% of our paycheck for food. You go to any other developed country, you're probably spending 20-25%. You go to a developing country, you're lucky if you're not spending 50 to 75% of your paycheck. So that means you have that 10 to 15% differential between us and everyone else to do what? Buy a jacket. Come to the Dairy Expo. Buy a car. Live in a nicer home. Take a vacation. Put money aside for college. Put money aside for retirement. You have that capacity that nobody else has. Why? Because American agriculture is so productive and the processing process is so efficient, it gets it to your store and to your home less expensively. Second advantage. Third advantage, jobs. One out of every 12 jobs is connected in this country to agriculture. It's no secret that when farm income is at record levels as it has been, farm implement shipments are at record levels. And these tractors and combines, they're pretty complicated pieces of machinery. I was standing next to a combine the other day, and I said to the guy, I said, how many parts are in this thing? I'm looking up, you know. He goes, about 50,000. 50,000 parts. Somebody's got to make those parts. Somebody's got to put them together. Somebody's got to fix them. Jobs, one out of every 12 jobs. Agriculture. Exports. You know, we hear about trade deficits, right? Always talking about trade deficits. America's got a trade deficit. Not in agriculture. For 50 consecutive years, we've had a trade surplus. We sell more to the world than the world sells to us. And last year, we had a record surplus, $42 billion. This year, we're going to have a very, very close to that, even in a tough year. Exports, also jobs. Security, surpluses. And then, of course, there's just the extraordinary diversity and the convenience of our food. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up in a... I had a tough situation. My mom was I was adopted out of an orphanage, and my mom, my parents who adopted me, they loved me, but my mom had alcoholism problems, and you know, we didn't have the convenience of popping something in a microwave. So it was, you know, the food was an interesting set of choices on particular days when mom was sick. Okay. Today. You know, you can have a meal, a pretty decent meal, in 10 or 15 minutes. I know this because my wife's running for Congress, and so I'm now on my own. And I have decided that the George Foreman grill is one of the great inventions of all time. But, you know, you can have a very good meal in 15 to 20 minutes. You don't have to take an hour to hour and a half when I was a kid. So we have extraordinary benefits here. But we never talk about them. And we get caught up in this GMO, organic, you know, and we fuss with each other. And meanwhile, we're asking the other 99% to vote on behalf of us in rural America for a farm bill. And they go, what's in it for us? Last point, and then I'll finish. I do this at every audience. You get another something from rural America that folks never get credit for. 16% of the population, nearly 40% of the military, comes from rural America. 40% of those kids going across Afghanistan, Iraq, I've been to both places. I've been to those camps. I've seen their conditions. I've been to Walter Reed. I've seen the injured kids coming home. 40% of those kids come from rural areas. Now, why is that? Folks will say, well, that's where the opportunity is. Kids leave the small town to go in the military. And, well, my nephew, Sam Bell, is 20 years old. His father's a lawyer. His mother works at a college. They are very, very financially in good shape. Sam was a B student. Probably if he'd worked hard, he could have been an A student. Sam was a B student, could have gone to virtually any college in the country. He chose to go in the Marines. He chose to go in the infantry. He just got back from Afghanistan a month or so ago after a seven-month tour. There are a lot of Sam Bells out there, and the reason there are is because Sam Bell grew up in a small town, Mount Pleasant, town of 8,000, surrounded by very, very good farmland. And when you grow up in a community like that, you learn a very basic value. And farmers sort of understand this. They look at the land, and they go, that's the most important thing I've got here. This is my livelihood. This is my, I'm rooted here. My history's here. And in order for that land to keep given to me and my family and my community, I have to give something back to it. So it gets replenished, right? We replenish the land. We make sure that it's properly cared for and tended, because it's important. And when you do that, and you do that, and you surround your community with that value system, it permeates the entire community. And so kids grow up thinking, if there's something important, it's worth investing back into. And then they think, well, what's more important than the country you live in that gives you the ability to dream and ability to do whatever you want to do? So I need to give something back to it. Now, how do I do that? Well, military service is one way. So we disproportionately have kids going in the military. That's what's at stake here. That's why we need Farm Bill. That's why we need to support rural America. That's why we need to create new opportunities for farm families. It isn't just to produce the food and fiber and feed and fuel that we need. It's to protect the value system that's central to this country. That's what's important. And that's why I'm so frustrated with the House. Because they could have done something good and positive and bipartisan. And they could have had a difference between the Senate, and they could have worked those differences out. But they chose not to have enough confidence in us to be able to have the debate before the election. They want to have it after the election. That's too bad. That's too bad. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.